progress. So I thought we'll have time to do the presentations during the week. I guess I was underestimating how much work it was to organize a conference and everything. So I won't be talking about that, but just to give you like a quick flash, it's basically, if you remember, Collins' talk about polarizing NMR quantum computer. So it's basically, he was working with 3 qubits in malonic acid. So my goal is to actually start using the hydrogen in malonic acid and just get 2 more qubits. I mean, there's possibly 4, but using some chemistry, we can get rid of 2, hopefully. We're still not sure of that. And get a 5 qubit, so that would be the biggest solid state quantum computer. And it will also be like, will also be 2 types of nucleus, which we haven't worked yet in the solid state of NMR. So if you guys want to know more, I'll be more than glad to talk about it during the break or whatever, so please ask me. It's a fairly neat project, I find. So instead, I'm going to be talking about basically quantum feedback control and, if time permit, application to continuous time error correction. All right, so here's how it's going to go. So I'm going to, of course, motivate why we want to do that. I'm going to describe quickly classical feedback control, then I'm going to generalize it to quantum feedback control. Then, again, I said if time permit, I'm going to start going to the quantum error correction that we know. Andreas explained that in the beginning of the week. And then I'm going to show you how we can generalize that to continuous time error correction. So the motivation for feedback, or actually motivation for control, well, it goes with the name, is you want to be able to control your system, right? We're trying to build a quantum computer, so what we want, we want to do it, to perform a task. And to perform that task, you have to be able to do it well, if you want to have something reliable. So yes, it's pretty much what's written there. So you want to increase the stability of your system. So if the system is very fragile, you want to make it robust against the environment, noise, stuff like this. Increase the control, obviously, and you want to suppress unwanted evolution, which basically is noise. The reason for continuous quantum error correction is basically feedback control. As we know it in classical and in quantum also, is you have an initial state, and you're driving into a final state, okay? Which is not what we want for quantum computing purposes. We don't want to control the initial to final state. We want to control the unitary evolution, okay? And actually, that's what by going to quantum continuous error correction, we'll be able to basically formalize or use the idea of feedback control to apply it to unitary evolution, just instead of just state to state evolution. All right, so basically, I haven't looked at my study in a while, so quantum control, so basically, yeah, so that's all of that what I explained. So you want to drive, in classical, you want to drive an initial state to a final state, and there's 2 ways of doing that. One way is called the open loop control, which is in quantum, anything quantum is pretty much what we do. So what we mean by that is, we have an estimate of the Hamiltonian of the system, or the evolution, and then you have the initial state of your system, and then you come up with some sort of algorithm or sort of control technique, apply it completely blind, and then you hope that at the end, you apply the actual evolution and you get the final state you're supposed to have. So that's the open loop. The closed loop, well, it's basically, it's easier to apply in classical term, which is you start applying your control, you look at your system, and if the system is behaving the right way, then you do nothing. But if it's behaving in a way different than you want, then you start changing your control. So it's basically, control, look, change your control parameter, control again, look again, and so far. And right now, you know that there's a problem for quantum control is that we cannot look. Right? Everybody should know here that looking in quantum mechanics is completely forbidden. Well, it's not, but you don't want to do that, right? So, exactly. All right, so let's just do a little bit of classical control, the way it works. So it's just a bunch of differential equation. So let's say you have a process, a stochastic process, okay? So you have noise. So basically what it means is you have a this is just a differential equation describing the evolution of your system. For example, if you have a free particle moving around, you know, dx can be basically the velocity, f would be the force, or the acceleration, and dt, so, you know, velocity equal acceleration dt, kind of. And then, so this G matrix and this dw, that's where the stochasticity comes in. So it's basically, this dw is a Gaussian, a very small random variable with Gaussian distribution that are very narrow. So it's basically model your noise, okay? That's called a Wigner process. And this G matrix here, it basically, it sort of models all your noise coupled to your actual, the actual evolution of your system. So when you do feedback, obviously you do some reading. So a reading is described like this. So it's basically you look at observable y, and then, you know, sort of this h there is like, it sort of describes how you look at it. And this rdw, it just means that your observation process is also stochastic. It's noisy. Okay? So all that, so it's called the Itô or Wigner process, and then there's an extensive literature on that. It's been known for a while. Oops, sorry. So normally with the classical feedback, right? Well, for any feedback, you always define a cost function. So basically, what you want to do is you want to optimize your process. And with that, you always associate a cost function, which means, well, it goes with the name, it means how much it costs to do that. So obviously, you will know that a cost function would depend on basically the state of your system, which is described by P here, right? It's a probabilistic state of system, classical probability here. And it's also dependent on your control parameters, right? So if you do a feedback and the feedback needs an insane amount of power, I want it to be expensive. I don't want to use too much power because you always have technology requirement. And also your cost function will depend on your final state, right? So if you basically what you want is you want to be as close as possible to the final state you're looking for, so you have to put a certain weight to how close you are. So then if you work out all the equations and everything, the equation I showed in the previous slides, you came up with this big, fat, ugly equation, which is called the Kushner-Stratonovich equation. If you just look at the first line, there's a very good chance you might have seen that one. It's just the Planck-Fokker equation, which is basically if you have a classical system and then you have a probability distribution of the initial state and then a certain dynamics given by F, and a noise given by G, then this is how your probability distribution would evolve under that stochastic process. Now, this part here is due to the fact that you're acquiring information on your system. Because if you remember this H matrix, was your observation process. Okay, so those are just, you know, mathematical artifacts, but basically what you have here is the dy, is actually what you measure in the lab. And this expected value of h is what you were expecting to measure. Okay, you have an estimate of your classical state, so when you do a measurement, you're expecting something, but you measure something different. Okay, so you take the difference, it's sort of how much is gonna change your new knowledge. And this equation describes the a posteriori probability density. So here the difference between a posteriori and a priori, Marcus, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you have, when you talk about a priori, a priori probability, it means that you have an estimate of your state, and the a priori probability density will be what you expect to see later. While in a posteriori is you have information up to now, and then the probability density would be what you expected you had before. Is that about that? Anyway, so basically what I'm saying is, you know, you have your initial condition, your initial state, you do measurements, and from measurement you can infer what state you have. or what state you had in the past, and then you can derive what state you have now. Okay? So that's classical control theory in a nutshell. So that's what I do here. So just a couple more comments. You have two, there's roughly two types of control in general. You have like optimal control, where basically you have, when you know exactly how your system behaves, so this F matrix, or you can see it as an Hamiltonian, you know precisely your Hamiltonian, and you just want to know, you know, your goal is to minimize C, your cost function. It's basically you want to do the best you can, and you have an excellent knowledge of your system. The problem with that is, yeah, it's the fact that you need a very precise knowledge. If you're a little shaky on your Hamiltonian, then now if you assume a certain Hamiltonian, you find an optimal solution, but your actual Hamiltonian is just a little different, then you know, your control might be completely off. So then that's where you turned out to the suboptimal robust control, where you find an optimal solution, but for a certain probability, a certain distribution of Hamiltonian. Okay? So now let's go to quantum feedback. So first of all, I mentioned that a little bit already on my previous talk, is, measurement will disturb the system. So if you want to do feedback, you have no choice to measure. You have to look at it, okay? So you can look at it in a hard way, like projective measurement, which basically destroys your state, or you can do a very weak measurement, which will affect your system, but just a tiny little bit, okay? So, weak measurement, and then, so because you're... So when you do a measurement, right, it's a little like, so you couple a measuring apparatus, your system, you get a measurement. So in some sense, if you throw the measurement away, like you don't look at it, well, your measuring apparatus, it's nothing else than just the environment, right? That's what the environment does. It's just look at your system and throw away the information. So if you look at the variable, you know, an observable Q, then the effect on Q on your density matrix will just be the Lemblad operator on it. And here I have to say that, you know, DA is sort of the noise on your system. So that's just like open system master equation. Any physicist seen that at some point? For mathematician, maybe no. But so basically that's how you describe an open system. Okay? You have Lembladian operators. So here both A and Q, so that's your Lemblad superoperator. And that's a differential equation for an open system, where H is obviously your Hamiltonian. So now I said that, you know, if you couple your measuring apparatus and throw away the information, that's what it looks like. Okay, you just lost information, but it's a measuring apparatus, so you know what you measure. So you have to find a way to throw it, you gain knowledge, right? So your master equation should be a little different. So you have Wiseman back in 90-something derived this big equation, which is basically, you know, exactly the same thing, but plus a little tidbit here. A new superoperator that basically corresponds to the information you acquire through your measurement, okay? And, so here measurement process, okay? Just you measure the variable Q, an observable Q, so that's, measurement process looks like that. You know, you couple it, and then basically you take the expected value of Q. And then this dy is just throwing in some random noise. Okay, it's a noisy process. So basically this guy here, as you can see, it's a little bit like the same thing. It's a little bit like the other part of the Planck-Fokker equation in the classical case. This is basically, right, so basically, if you look at it, if it's Q there, that's what you expect to measure, right? The trace of your operator times your density matrix, that's what you expect it to measure. And this is, if you work out the math very quickly, is actually what you actually measure. Okay, so it's kind of the same idea. This OH, it just throw in information on what you measured versus what you were expecting to measure. And this, so here by row C, I mean density matrix conditional, okay, conditional on measurement. So for the same reason that the Kushner-Stratonovich, the other slides, It's the a posteriori density matrix. So given information, that's what you expect you have at the moment. So it's a conditional density matrix, conditional on your measurement. Oh yeah, that's something took me a while to figure out, is that this whole equation, this H matrix here, is dependent on a certain model of measurement. So in their cases, what they were doing is they were looking at atom and cavity, where they throw in lasers. And one of the big source of noise is that the laser you throw in the cavity, it doesn't always reflect them. Some of them go through the cavity. So normally, they just lose the photons and forget about them. So what they started to do, they started to measure the number of photons that was going through. And from that, they were able to infer this, well, to get some information about the state of the atom within the cavity. And then if you work out everything, so you know, because you sort of accumulate the number of photons, you're going to have a Poissonian distribution of photon number, and then it's big, it's ugly. It's a very ugly problem, but very elegant final solution. So this basically, how much time? Oh, all right, so this, I'll just go quickly through it. So that's one strategy for doing optimal control. It's called a Bellman equation, which basically, well, as opposed to the classical Bellman equation. So the only thing it says is, if you have a system and you want to control it optimally for a certain time t, so slice that time in two, and what it says is the optimal time, the optimal process for the second part of your time is basically the optimal process given the fact that you have that you found an optimal process for the first interval. So what it means, if you slice your control in n time, you can just optimize on n. No, yeah, optimize the last given that you optimize the first one, the one before, given that you optimize the one before that, so you can just sort of backpropagate your control strategy. And you know, if you work through it, you get that equation, but you know, I won't go through it too much. So we can see here the optimal cost function, if you look at that, is given that, you know, the probability of getting to this to a certain state at, you know, at one time step later. So the probability of getting there given that you were in a certain state and the time interval Ti with a certain parameter that you already done, then you basically, you know, optimize that over all possible state that you can have at later time. But you know, that's just details and I won't go too much into it. So here's an example that was that Doherty and Nebuchi came up with, is just applying all this machinery to a particle in a double well potential. Okay. So you get, you know, you have a system, then your Hamiltonian is given by, well, you know, the free particle Hamiltonian, I assume mass equal one, and you get your potential, which is a double well. So you start and you put your particle in one well. And your goal is to keep it there and switch it on demand, and keep it there and switch it. But the problem is, due to thermal fluctuation, you basically have a noise coming in that will sort of help you, not help you, but due to thermal fluctuation, the particle will tend to tunnel on the other one. Okay? So basically your goal is to combat, to fight against this thermal fluctuation. So obviously what you want to do is you want to make a reading on where the particle is, right? And if it's not at the right place, you apply a linear Hamiltonian to basically bring it back. So basically what I'm saying is, if this guy starts tunneling there, so basically you apply an Hamiltonian that, let me get a chart. So you have your potential, which is like this. So if your particle, if you read that your particle is actually there, and you don't want it there, you can apply an extra X in your Hamiltonian, kind of tilt your potential so that the particle will tend to fit back in. Okay? So that's exactly what we do here. So basically we measure where it is. So your Hamiltonian now is the original Hamiltonian plus the feedback Hamiltonian, okay? Which we decided to be a linear term. And then depending on what we read, we make it strong or not. So depending on like how much you want to tilt your potential. So they basically simulated that with the quantum Bellman equation. And for yes, Oka? So that's it, right? So it's when you do your measurement process. So actually, I haven't wrote the measurement process on it. So right here, right? So we would be measuring our Q would be basically measuring X, right? So we look weakly at where the particle is. And at some point, you want it, let's say that the two holes are at 2 and minus 2, right? You're supposed to read 2 all the time. But at some point, you read, let's say, minus 1, you're like, well, it might be starting to go on the other one. So you start tilting a little bit to bring it back to minus 2, okay? No. It's a projected measurement. So basically, okay, you couple, it's a little more tricky than what I explained. So basically, what you do is you couple your system to a measuring apparatus, and the effective thing is like measuring the position. You measure a variable that you can infer the position from it. Okay, so it's not necessarily projective, but sort of slightly projective, if you know what I mean. So it sort of means like, most of the time you won't project it, and every once in a while you're gonna project it in that place. So what we call a jump operator, which is a whole different thing of stochastic Schrödinger equation, which is also very ugly, but. So here you see like result from simulation they have. So that axis is the position of the particle, and this is the time. Okay, and their goal was to keep the particle in one well, switch it to the other one, keep it there, switch it again. And that the strength of the control, so basically the strength of this U variable here. So you see here, so that's a measurement of where it is, so it start moving a little bit. So it's shaky a little, so you have a little bit of control. So you see every time you have a peak there, you have also a peak there. Then you want to switch it, right? So basically you apply, then you start tilting your potential. So it switches to the other one. But then obviously you want to switch, you want to stop it there. So you tilt it a little bit on the other side and then you kind of balance it. So that's why you kind of take a little while to get there. But once you're there, you keep and then and so on. Well, that's basically all I had to say for, that was a very quick crash course on control theory. Yes, Anka? This? I don't know, man. No, that was just simulation so far. They just say, it's a toy model. No, that was a... But I guess like a double well at Josephson Junction has double well, I think. Okay. So, all right, so let's go to quantum error correction. So I won't go to the detail of what error correction is. I think by now a few people already explained what it was. So, it's a software solution for errors. You encode it in a bigger space, and then you measure syndrome. You can infer what the error was, and then you can correct it, everything unitarily. And so on, so I won't spend too much detail. So that's just explaining what the 3-qubit. Has anybody never heard of the 3-qubit quantum error correction? Awesome. So we encode it like this. You can correct for bit flip error. So basically, if one bit flip, then you can deduce which one flips by measuring basically those two operators on the 3-qubits, and then depending on what you measure, you can infer if it happened on the first one, second one, or third one. So now we're gonna apply the whole thing, which was all discrete time, right? It's you encode, you assume hat MR, control knot, that's what computer scientists see physics as, is apply control knot and apply it toffoli. What really happened in labs is everything is continuous time, right? You don't apply a control knot. You apply a certain coupling for a certain time and then some gate that takes time. So our goal here is really to, well, bring it continuous. So work with actual Hamiltonian or actual Master equation. So basically, that's exactly what this equation is saying here. It's just taking the discrete time and put it in differential equation. So a quick explanation is, so your density matrix evolved as, that's your noise. We said the noise creates a bit flip. Okay, so we've got a certain noise rate, and what the bit flip corresponds to, well, to an x value, so it's going to be your, you know, flip your bit, so it's, that's your Lindbladian operator. Your Lindblad operator, sorry. This are the three operators you're actually measuring on your system. So they're going to induce, obviously, if you look at it, they're going to induce some decoherence. This is due to the fact that because you measured them, you know what they are. So that was the stochastic master equation that I showed you before. And this will be your feedback control, right? So if you learn that your first bit flip, then you flip it back. If you've learned that your second bit flip, then you flip it back, okay? And that's how we're gonna decide, so that's measurement process, and that's how we're gonna decide what the control parameters are gonna be. So, you know, if you work through a little bit, you'll see that, you know, if you have an error on the first guy, then all those Z1 value would be minus one. This measurement would be minus one, would be one, minus one. And to be honest, I think there's an error here. I think that one should be a plus here. I made a mistake. So anyway, so if you look quickly through it, it means that if your first qubit flip, then the control parameter one would be one. Well, it'd be one over eight, u over eight, and all the other one would be zero. If your second one flip, U2 will be 1 and the rest will be 0. So basically what it means is, by using this control strategy is, you know, you read that the first one flip, you flip it back. That's all it says. So some people apply that, and you know, there's graph for, I won't show it, so result I'll show you a little later. But the problem here is I showed you, I describe a control strategy, but I never talk about cost function. Right, so I don't know how costly it is. So one thing you can do is introduce a cost function, and that's where actually the whole quantum feedback becomes interesting for quantum computing, is that in quantum error correction, you don't need to know what state you have, as long as you know in which subspace it is. Right, because that's what error correction is you put a state in a, you encode it in a certain subspace. So you don't have to look what state you actually have encoded. You just have to make sure it doesn't go out of the subspace. Okay? So that's a very nice strategy. It's basically, you know, your cost function for it is you make sure that, you know, the cost function is one minus basically your overlap of your state with your encoded subspace, which is, you know, projected on your encoded subspace, just given by this, which is a sum of your stabilizer of the code. And the beauty of it is you can show that this overlap there is completely independent of your encoded state. Okay, it just depends on the fact that your original, you know, it just depends on the fact that your initial state is assumed to be encoded. So you can solve the stochastic master equation by assuming, you know, that my initial state was zero encoded or the identity encoded. It doesn't really matter. So now with your cost function, what you want to do is you want to minimize the cost function, which basically, you know, turns out to be minimizing this function there. And because this function is linear, it basically means you just want to minimize each of them. Which happened that, well, if basically, you know, your control would be that if you put U1 to be proportional to the sign of it, then all those guys will always be positive, and it's going to minimize this basically this function, and that's what we have here. Okay, so basically here, what happened? So the whole thing, if you want to simulate it or you want to do it, is your system go, you acquire some knowledge, some observation, and then from that you use the stochastic master equation. You deduce what your conditional density matrix is. So basically you sort of deduce what you think the density matrix is at that point. And then from that you can calculate those expected value, because they are expected value condition. And then from those value, then you infer the value of your control parameter, and then you update your, you turn your knob and update your control parameters. So from there, they did some simulation, and that's what they show. I'll come back to that little point later. So if my memory is good, is this is the fidelity for if you don't, for no, if you have a bit flip channel and you don't correct at all. Okay? Very low fidelity. And then that one here is just if you put three qubits together and you throw them down the throw down a bit flip channel, it's gonna decrease even quicker, right? Because if you have the triple coherence, then it flips three times faster. Well, not three times faster, but yeah, three times faster. And then, so that's their curve they have, okay? Using continuous error correction. So it starts, actually it's very, very bad at the beginning. Okay, it just follows the worst case scenario. And then it starts being a little better to the fact that you can actually beat an unencoded one qubit. And the reason why it's it takes a long time, it's sort of because you do measurement, and then you know, so it's the whole algorithm. It kind of, in a nutshell, it takes a little bit for your system, for your whole rig, to find out there's, oh no, there's noise, and I have to adjust myself. It's sort of an adjusting time. And then I think we don't see it on the. Do you guys see it? It's like a line here. Sort of. So okay, so follow my pointer. It goes like that. Okay. So that line is the fidelity line for discrete time error correction. So they're claiming, you know, at this point here, after a certain time, we beat them, so our, you know, continuous error correction is better. My problem is that fidelity curve, they just do one step of error correction. And you can think of continuous time error correction sort of as the limit of doing multiple steps of error correction, right? And you know, and you do, and this, the number of time you do step goes with smaller and smaller time interval. So basically you will have, I would personally have expect this line there to be very, very close to one. As you would expect that if you do multiple rounds of error correction. So it's kind of, you know, sweeping a couple of things under the carpet. But I'm pretty sure ultimately though, you know, this, because this line always curve, and if you go at infinity, maybe it's still better. It's still something to, and that thing here, it basically tells you how far is the fidelity, they call it the subspace fidelity. So they said, like, even though sometimes you lose fidelity, that tells you that my state, at least, is still in the, my encoded subspace. But one problem with that is that in discrete time error correction, the one thing is if you let's say you have a two-qubit error, you're going to deduce the wrong syndrome, and you're going to correct for the wrong error, but at the end you're still going to be in the encoded space. So in discrete time error correction, this curve is always at one. Right? No matter what you do, even you completely screw up, your state is still in the encoded space at the end of the error correction step. Do I have time left? A couple minutes. Okay, let me go very, very quickly on that one. So basically what I showed so far is how to use, quantum feedback. So basically a quantum feedback is feedback with classical information. Okay, so you read in something, that's classical information, you feed in your algorithm and then puts out parameters and then you retweak. What you can do is you can do coherent control or coherent feedback, which is, you know, this actually, you know, shows the same way of doing the three-qubit error correction, but using two external insula to actually measure your syndrome. So, yeah, I won't go to the details, but trust me, it's the same. Basically, you know, you, you throw in the parity of those two states in that insula and that insula, and then depending on their value, you know which one flips, so that's what those Stoffeli does. So now the goal is to take all that circuit and make it continuous. And that's how you do it, is just for that one, which we call the syndrome detection, there's a HC associated with it, a certain Hamiltonian. So if you take that Hamiltonian, you exponentiate it to, I think it's time of pi over 2, you get exactly that gate, and this gate is the same thing. You can describe it as an Hamiltonian. So now basically you say that the full Hamiltonian for this, for a very tiny, tiny time, you can use the BCH, Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff approximation to say, okay, so for a very tiny time, I can approximate my full Hamiltonian of those two guys by this little bit there. And then what you say is, instead of detecting and correcting, I'm going to apply this Hamiltonian. So basically what's going to happen is I'm going to detect and correct at the same time all the time. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what quantum error correction is, continuous time quantum error correction is. So basically, you know, that would be your master equation describing it. So here I didn't use any control. I didn't use any control or feedback control that I explained before. But in some sense, it is feedback, right? Because I'm reading coherently, observing my system, and then correcting it through the Toffelis. But here the problem is, thing I forgot is, once you did that once, then your ancilla qubit are rubbish. They're no good anymore. So you have to throw it out, bring two new ancilla in the zero state. So one way to do that in the lab is basically you have to refresh them. Okay, so basically you have to find a way to purify your qubits, and it looks, in a master equation, it looks like this, where your I minus is your flipping operator. So, okay, so it brings a one state to a zero state, so I guess it should be a I plus. I think it's another mistake there. So basically, you know, I mean, that's what the I plus does, right? So if you're in state pointing down or state one, it flips it to zero, and if you're at zero, it does nothing. Well, it annihilates it. So that's your complete, basically that's your complete dynamics of your system. You have the error due to your bit flip channel, and then you have your, basically your cooling of the ancilla, and then you have your Hamiltonian, which detect and correct at the same time. And then here they show a bunch of fidelity curve through that. So all the one here is the K. K has something to do with the strength of your Hamiltonian, so basically like how fast, in some sense, how fast you correct and detect. So obviously you will, you know, expect that the stronger you detect, well, the higher your fidelity is going to be. And there's also they also show other result in terms of lambda, so how fast you can refresh. So obviously at the end you cannot, if you correct very fast, then you have to refresh very fast. But if you refresh too fast and correct and, you know, do your correction at a lower rate, then everything starts, you know, being shaky, so there's sort of there's an optimal value of your refreshing rate with respect to your correcting rate. And yeah, that was a 45-minute talk, which I just put in 25 minutes. So yeah, so at the end, conclusion, you know, feedback control, you know, it's just you fight the dynamics of the system, or you fight the unwanted dynamics of your system. And yeah, I mean, just, that's a, you can read it. And I'm done. Thank you. I was that clear? Yeah, Nathan. Well, cooling is, well, that's what we do. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at your master equation, I mean, this master equation is whatever happened in delta T, right? So your error happened, your cooling happened. If you ask me if I can do my cooling within my Hamiltonian, then it's no, because cooling is not unitary. Okay, it's a non-unitary process. That's simulated. Everything's simulated. Absolutely not. Because, I mean, that's the problem. I mean, and they mentioned it. I forgot to mention it, but, I mean, nobody hides it. If you look at those Hamiltonian, I mean, we did expand it in terms of polymatrix. They're so disgusting. They're very, very ugly. They have a lot of terms, and they're funny terms like Z times Y, X. It's, so no, it's not a very nice way of implementing it. But we still, I mean, Colm explained, right, the whole grape algorithm we use for finding pulses randomly. Using that, there is a chance of coming up with the unitary we want. But like this, you know, working on paper, here's the Hamiltonian, forget it. Yeah, maybe, yeah, totally. Because that, I mean, all those, is, there's not that many literature on it. Like, crap. But basically, like, all the paper I put there, that's almost all the papers you find in continuous time error correction and quantum control. So, no, it's not extensive. I personally think it's a fairly neat idea, so maybe it's going to take off at some point, maybe not. So we'll see, you know, I definitely keep that in mind to do some further research. Continuous time what measurement? Yeah. And then, no, that thing is not really suitable for NMR. I don't think so, because, well, for one, the fact that it's ensemble quantum computing, so the whole weird weak measurement thing is, it's a little weird. But they have applied that experimentally in Australia. So basically that was the cavity thing I was talking about. So it's not demolition, because anyway the photons are lost. So they're just basically recuperating lost something that is lost was anyway, and then they just use that for control. So in some sense that's a weak measurement, because you don't disturb your system by reading it, because it was already disturbed anyway, right? So it's basically you're reading the environment and get information out of it. Yeah, that's in that one. But I would suggest go read this PhD thesis instead. It's a bit more clear, because that one is extremely dense. It's very hard to follow. There's lots and lots of mathematics. So the PhD thesis is also very ugly, but it's got more step in it. It's on his website. So just go on Wiseman's website and it's there.
Okay.
All right.